from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, just an imaginative exercise for a moment. If you were the air conditioning system of a public radio station in New Orleans, Louisiana, when would you choose to go on the blink? That's right, Labor Day weekend. So, sitting here, you'll hear that little wind noise. That's me fanning myself, because that's what people in the South used to do. I'm fanning myself. I declare. News, ladies and gentlemen, though, first of all, to make you hot, if not bothered, from the inspectors general. Dateline Washington. This isn't anything that needs to get you upset. Some facilities that handle the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile misplaced classified bomb components under their care, according to the Energy Department's IG. It's just nuclear weaponry stuff. By the way, the IAEA says that Iran has ramped down their nuclear program and is cooperating. So how are we going to go to war with them now? Maybe. I don't like their music. The department's inspector general also found there was confusion at the Energy Department facilities over who was responsible for keeping track of weapons parts. It's him. I know it's him, because it ain't me. John Brame, a spokesman for the Energy Department's National Nuclear Security Administration. Well, that sounds effective, said his agency disagreed with the recommendations. He said the parts, which he declined to identify, were later found. Which, if I know the English language, suggests that at one point they were lost. The IG's audit, it was a little noticed two-page document released in late July, found that two of the three Energy Department sites did not track, quote, many, unquote, classified weapons parts in their custody. The facilities, quote, could not readily account for or locate some of the items included in our inventory sample. The Inspector General's office would not elaborate beyond the summary document or say when the audit was done. But, you know, that's just nice people doing nice things. And speaking of clean, safe, plentiful, cheap, safe, clean, nuclear power, the Tennessee of course, that was weaponry. This is other nuclear kinds of stuff. The Tennessee Valley Authority is vying to host a national demonstration project for recycling spent nuclear fuel, according to U.S. Representative Zach Womp. I don't make him up. Zach Womp. Quote, I believe TVA is going to prove to our country that you can deal with the number one liability associated with the nuclear industry, and that is the waste. Really? That's a liability? I thought that was a feature. America needs nuclear power to meet growing demand for energy and power sources that don't foul the air, he says. But the country will never be able to find enough places to bury the radioactive waste already piling up at nuclear plants, including TVA's, according to Zach Womp, who's a Republican. He says, quote, you can't build Yucca Mountain after Yucca Mountain after Yucca Mountain, referring to the long-stalled Nevada site for nuclear waste. And then he gets even more honest. Quote, as a matter of fact, we're proving it's kind of hard to build the first one. Unquote, Zach Womp. Hello, welcome to the show.
Fire!
From the shores of Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, in New Orleans, where the big fish kill happened this week. Yeah, baby. About a million of them. No, I can't even smell them here. That's how little air there is in here. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. News of the new Iraq for your listening pleasure on this Labor Day weekend. The Pentagon says the cost of the Iraq war has surpassed $330 billion. That's all. Just $330 billion? Well, the president's going to ask for 50 more. That'll get up to a nice round $400 billion. Who was it? Some think tank about 3 years ago estimated that the eventual cost of the war will be $500 billion. They're getting very close. Meanwhile, I think Paul Wolfowitz said it would cost $50 million. The Afghanistan war has cost $78 billion. So you get what you pay for. The men and women who've stepped forward to report corruption in the massive effort to build Iraq have been, here's a multiple choice question, A, given presidential medals of freedom, or B, vilified, fired, and demoted. I'm sorry, the answer is B. For daring to report illegal arms sales, Navy veteran Donald Vance says he was imprisoned by the American military in a compound outside Baghdad and subjected to harsh interrogation methods. But were they enhanced, would be my question. There were times, he says, huddled on the floor in solitary confinement with that head-banging music blaring dawn to dusk, which I hope it was tap, and interrogators yelling the same questions over and over that Vance began to wish he had just kept his mouth shut. He had thought he was doing a good and noble deed when he started telling the FBI about the guns and the landmines and the rocket launchers being sold for cash, no receipts, he said. He told a federal agent that the buyers were Iraqi insurgents, American soldiers, State Department workers, and Iraqi embassy and ministry employees. The seller was the Iraqi-owned company he worked for, Shield Group Security Company. Well, that sounds safe to me. It's the Shield Group. It was a Walmart for guns, he says. It was all illegal and everyone knew it. So Vance says he blew the whistle supplying photos and documents to an FBI agent in his hometown of Chicago because he didn't know whom to trust in Iraq. I'd say tell the General Petraeus. We're supposed to trust him, aren't we? For his trouble, he got 97 days in Camp Cropper, the American military prison that once held Saddam Hussein, and he was classified a security detainee. By the way, Katie Couric, to burnish her news credentials, take the perky out of her news credentials and put the burnish in, or burnish the perky, is in Iraq, and she got, quote, debriefed on the CBS Sunday Yak show. And by debriefed, basically, we need a new word, really, because these people say, I'm reporting from Baghdad, when actually what she did for about 10 minutes was just repeat the details of a conversation she had with General Petraeus. Questions like, do you get the sense that General Petraeus is going to recommend that the surge continue? Yes, I do. Well, he'll say that, Katie, and you could call him up from Washington or New York. I'm on the ground repeating would be, I think, a more accurate verb. Anyway, President Bush seeks to end criticism from the Pentagon and the State Department of the British decision to pull out of Basra. He says he's fine about the handover. Well, if it's okay for them to pull out, and General Sir Mike Jackson. No, no, no. This is the British Mike Jackson. This is the one who was born white. The head of the British Army during the invasion of Iraq has launched a scathing attack on the United States for the way it handled the post-war administration of the country. He says the approach taken by Donald Rumsfeld was, quote, intellectually bankrupt. Well, we have made bankruptcy easier, so. He describes Rumsfeld's claim that U.S. forces don't do nation building as, quote, nonsensical. This is the most outspoken criticism of American military policy in Iraq to come from a senior British officer, highlighting the deep-seated tension between the British command and the Pentagon during the buildup to and the aftermath of the Iraq campaign. He says Rumsfeld was, quote, one of those most responsible for the current situation in Iraq. Now, we had our accountability moment. Crucially, the general writes, Rumsfeld refused to deploy enough troops to maintain law and order after the collapse of Saddam's regime, discarded detailed plans for the post-conflict administration of Iraq that had been drawn up by the U.S. State Department. Yes, that's been mentioned before, among other places on this broadcast. Nice of Mike, Sir Mike, General Sir Mike, to bring it back up to public notice. He says he believes the entire U.S. approach to tackling global terrorism is inadequate because it relies too heavily on military power at the expense of nation-building and diplomacy. Yeah, but military power just costs $330 billion. The other stuff would be... Jackson doesn't believe the Brits have been defeated in Basra, as was claimed by U.S. military sources last month. He says the failure of the U.S.-led coalition to suppress the Iraqi insurgency 4 years down the line is down to the Pentagon's refusal to deploy enough troops. A combined force of 400,000 would be needed to control a country the size of Iraq. Wasn't that what General Shinseki said? But even with the extra troops recently deployed for the surge, the coalition has struggled to reach half that figure. All the post-war planning had been done by the State Department, but General Sir Mike is critical of President Bush's decision to hand control of the post-invasion to the Pentagon. All the planning carried out by the State Department went to waste. It was an ideological article of faith that the coalition forces would be accepted as a liberating army. He and other British officers were opposed to the decision to disband the Iraqi army after Saddam's overthrow, a decision he said, quote, was very short-sighted. He also reveals that he and other senior officers had doubts, ladies and gentlemen, about the weapons of mass destruction dossier presented by the Blair government in late 2002. Its release caused a stir in military circles, reveals General Sir Mike Jackson, former head of the British Army, particularly the suggestion that the U.K. could face a threat of attack at 45 minutes' notice. We all knew, quoting, it was impossible for Iraq to threaten the U.K. mainland. The Scud missiles that Saddam had could barely have reached our bases on Cyprus. General Sir Mike Jackson, ladies and gentlemen, checking in. He can be, I guess, faulted like so many others for, on the single ground. Now you tell us. Timing. You got to get a book out. Got to wait for the book deal. Thank you. Thank you very much. No damage done. No harm done. No harm, no foul. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Wait till Colin Powell gets his book deal. Powell. Thousands, this is from the Times of London, thousands of wooden toy Noah's Arks made in China are being recalled across Britain after excessive lead was found in the paint. The toy workshop, which has been marketing its own handmade designs for 12 years, sounded the alert. Officers of the government found the problem during a routine check. A batch of 2,000 of the arcs delivered this year from a factory in China was discovered to have lead paint levels above the British legal maximum. This is the first time a British upmarket toy maker has been affected by problems from China. The brightly colored Noah's Arks are one of the biggest sellers for the toy workshop, based in Shrewsbury. Characters featured include Noah, pairs of elephants, lions, zebras, monkeys, giraffes, and crocodiles, all covered with lead. The batch concerned consists of medium and large arks. Mini arks are safe. Most of the products were made previously in Sri Lanka, but growing demand led the company to start using manufacturers in China. Speaking of which, the famous British toy store Hamleys, the world's most famous, according to the Sunday Telegraph, is turning to UK manufacturers for children's toys following the China toy scares. Managers at Hamleys have already held meetings with British toy makers as part of plans to revitalize the country's ailing toy maker sector and reassure parents over the quality and safety of the toys. The majority of the British toy industry has come to a grinding halt, says a spokesman for Hamleys. For anything plastic, we, like the rest of the industry, are still beholden to China. This is from the Sunday Telegraph. A resurgence in interest in British toy manufacturers will not come too soon for the beleaguered industry. One toy maker says the problem is the market is shrinking. We used to consider that the age group for toys went up to 12 or 13, but that has dropped to 7 or 8, after which children get interested in mobile phones and fashion. Got to get sexed up. Also, from outside the bubble, from the Sunday Telegraph, campaigning against what they say. You'd think this American would cover this. I haven't seen this covered by American papers, hence the Sunday Telegraph. Campaigning against what they say is widespread and unacceptable discrimination in the workplace and society, the American Mustache Institute is vowing to restore well-tended facial hair to the status it enjoyed in the 1970s. I think nobody... Oh, yeah, everybody were. But they're saying the 70s. The Institute is now dedicated to fighting to create a, quote, climate of acceptance and understanding for all mustachioed Americans. A recent poll found more than half of American women refuse to kiss a man with a mustache. Some have said the look reminds them of the Village People, 70s porn stars, and rednecks. Nobody mentioned Geraldo Rivera. Well, I guess he's sort of covered by one of those categories. I don't. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it was permissible for a trial lawyer to throw someone off a jury on the grounds that they had a mustache. The American Mustache Institute stands ready to assist any American claiming to have been discriminated against. Executive Director Aaron Perlett told the Sunday Telegraph, there's no question there exists a measure of discrimination. People feel they have to shave before a job interview. We can win over young people for whom a mustache is a perfect means of self-expression, he says, and it's easier than a tattoo. He dates the death of the mustache to the departure from American television screens of Walter Cronkite, owner of what he calls, quote, the most trusted mustache in the media. But what about Geraldo? And the end of Tom Selleck's reign as Magnum in 1988. New York City Comptroller William Thompson, who's expected to run for mayor, has just shaved off his mustache. And finally, in news from outside the bubble, British military, just to prove that we and the Brits, despite all of our arguing about Iraq, really do have an awful lot in common. This from The Guardian. British military scientists sent hundreds of Indian, that's a dot, not feather, soldiers into gas chambers and exposed them to mustard gas, documents uncovered by The Guardian reveal. British military did not check up on the Indian soldiers after the experiments to see if they developed any illnesses, although it's now recognized that mustard gas can cause cancer and other diseases. Many of the Indian soldiers suffered severe burns on their skin, including their genitals, leaving them in pain for days and even weeks. Some had to be hospitalized. These newly discovered documents at the British National Archives. This was when India was still under colonial rule. The experiments took place over more than 10 years during and before World War II. They were conducted by scientists from Britain's Porton Down Chemical Warfare Station in Wiltshire. The Indian tests are a little known part of the huge program of chemical warfare testing on humans undertaken by the Brits. More than 20,000 British soldiers were subjected to chemical warfare trials involving poison gases between 1916 and 1989. Many of these British soldiers have alleged they were duped into taking part in the tests, which have damaged their health in the years after the trials. The tests were used to determine how much gas was needed to produce a casualty on the battlefield. Porton Down scientists wanted to find out in the early 1930s if mustard gas inflicted greater damage on Indian skin compared to British skin. Officials of the facility argue that trials took place in a different era, during a conflict, and so their conduct should not be judged by modern standards, because our standards for humane conduct, ladies and gentlemen, as you may have noticed, are so damn high. The Ministry of Defense of Britain could not say whether the Indian soldiers were volunteers in the experiments. Any bets? Place your bets. News from outside the bubble, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, there was a spate of resignations on the Republican side of the aisle this week. We'll get to one of them moments from now. But Tony Snow, the White House press secretary for about the past year or so, announced he was stepping down because he needed to make more money for his family. He's got kids in college. And the embattled Attorney General of the United States after being subjected to withering criticism by senators from his own party. Finally announced this week, he was resigning, stepping down to go back to Texas, where it all began. He said in his parting remarks that he was the living embodiment. He had experienced the American dream. Now, that came as something of a surprise to me because I didn't realize the American dream consisted of finding one powerful patron who would then proceed to give you every job you held in adult life. If that's the American dream, I missed it. So I'm putting the call out for that patron right now because I need me a series of jobs. So he also said that every day, even his worst days as Attorney General, were better than his father's best days. We're going to try to fix that right now.
I was loyal to George Bush whenever he'd call, even if he wanted nothing at all. I was loyal on the rise, I was loyal on the fall, 'cause even I know what the point of the fall is. Give the critics the head of Alberto
Gonzalez.
The Geneva Conventions I helped redefine, calling them quaint. I think that quote was mine, 'cause certain detainees are just over the line. In the room with top lawyers, it's clear where the gall is. In the legalese head of Alberto
Gonzalez.
The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. In Texas, George Bush named me to his Supreme Court. Could the big one be next? I'd sure need his support. So my advice was the most approving sort. If I wanted the robe, I'd give nothing but solace and let Bush be the head of Alberto
Gonzalez.
We wanted to change prosecutors for friends. A big Senate hearing is where that trail ends. The truth doesn't break, but it certainly bends. I gave a display of what total lack of recall is. Just a memory hole in the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. I'll spend time with my family, I'll spend time alone. I'll sit by my computer, I'll sit by my phone, hoping that my old friend will just throw me a bone. Even though I know how unlikely that call is, so I'll just take back the head of Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Gonzalez.
coming, obviously. The madam's got the cutest personality. And think of all the books by DuBarry's looks. We're made out of toast of fairy. She's got her well-developed personality. What did Romeo see in Juliet? Figaro, Figaret, Jupiter. Had the boys entranced. No doubt it was easy to see. She knows how to use her personality. Take dictation well. Never sit on a boss's knee. Unless she got her smoking personality. A girl can get some way. Spite a scraggly hair. With pigeon toes and knock-knees. She got herself a perfect personality. Why do certain girls get certain things? Like sable coats and wedding rings. By guys who got their game. Got the kind of soul. What a wonderful brother I'd be. Tell me how much you dig my personality. 'Cause baby, you got the cutest personality.
This is Le Show from steamy New Orleans. It's steamy inside because the air conditioning took the weekend off, don't you know? And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Front and center, top of the apology pile, trying to put it all behind him. Pardon me. Trying to put an end to the stall tactics. Pardon me. Trying to get on top of the situation. Pardon me, Senator Larry Craig, yesterday.
To Idahoans, I represent, to my staff, my Senate colleagues, but most importantly, to my wife and my family, I apologize for what I have caused. I am deeply sorry. I apologize to the people of our great state for being unable to serve out a term to which I have been elected.
Isn't that ironic? Sorry. But still not gay.
I am not gay. I've never been gay. I've never used Ben gay.
Dateline. Somewhere in the world, French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner has apologized for saying Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki should be replaced. Al-Maliki had demanded an apology after comments Kouchner made in an interview with Newsweek. Kouchner apologized on the French radio station and later referred to the incident in a speech. Speaking to journalists, he said it had been a clumsy error. He said it isn't the role of the French foreign minister to decide who will be another country's prime minister. That's the Americans' business. No, he didn't say that. All he'd wanted to do was pass on the criticisms of Iraqis. But he admitted that while speaking English, he'd forgotten to say exactly what it was he had understood. Football apologies. National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell is announcing New England Patriots safety Rodney Harrison has been suspended for the first four games of the season for violating the league's substance abuse policy. Harrison says he purchased a banned substance, but stressed, "Not once did I use steroids. I've apologized to my family," he says, "my friends, and I would like to take this opportunity to apologize to my teammates. I apologize to them for being a distraction. I apologize to the entire New England Patriots organization and the fans who have supported me." Harrison says he took human growth hormone to stimulate or to accelerate the healing process for football injuries. But he's really sorry. And Michael Vick apologized this week for using bad judgment and making bad decisions. "First, I want to apologize for all the things that I've done and I have allowed to happen," he said, entering a guilty plea on charges of running a dogfighting ring. "I made a mistake. Those things just can't happen. Dogfighting is a terrible thing, and I do reject it." He also apologized to all the young kids out there for my immature acts and what I did, and what I did was very immature. "So that means I need to grow up." And perfect timing, department. Vic also says, "Through this situation, I found Jesus and asked him for forgiveness." It's timing. It's timing. Dateline San Diego, a woman whose concerns about a group of Middle Eastern passengers apparently caused a Tuesday night flight from San Diego to Chicago to be aborted, contradicted the airline's account of the incident. Six of the seven men involved have retained an attorney and want an apology. Lee Robbins of Richmond, Virginia, said she got off an American Airlines flight rather than take the flight with seven Middle Eastern men aboard. She says she now regrets the incident. When the rest of the passengers got off the plane, the group of seven Iraqi and Iraqi-American men were immediately separated from the rest of the passengers and questioned by authorities. The men worked for a defense contractor and had been training Marines. The men were baffled about why they were being questioned and felt embarrassed. "Everyone who didn't look like us went off and did whatever they wanted," said one of them. They showed airport officials their identification as well as certificates of appreciation for the work they'd done. The airport officials apologized to the men, telling them it was all a mistake. Yeah, it's a good idea to bring the mustache back, because you get treated well on airplanes. And a couple of presidential apologies. No, not for Katrina, not for Iraq. What country do you think you're living in? George Bush has apologized in advance to the people of Sydney, Australia, for the disruptions that will be experienced across parts of that city as a result of the APEC summit. Not personally being aware of exactly how much of the Sydney business district will go into lockdown, they're building a 10-foot-high steel wall through the middle of Sydney, that's all. The president did say he was sorry to the people at the summit would, quote, put out. "I apologize to the extent that I inconvenience people. I hope people understand why it's done. I hope it doesn't disrupt their lives too much." The week-long summit will cost $300 million, more than half that amount being designated for security. They've declared Friday, September 7th, a holiday, hoping people will leave the city. Well, it's Build a Wall in the City Day. That's the holiday. And the president has apologized to the widow of a Wiccan soldier, a soldier of the Wiccan belief, after she was excluded from a Nevada meeting this week that the president held with the families of soldiers killed in combat. Roberta Stewart, her husband, was killed in Afghanistan in 2005, was left off the invitation list for the private meeting, even though other members of her husband's family were invited. She heard about the exclusion from her mother-in-law. Stewart said she concluded it was done because of her public fight to force the federal government to engrave the symbol for the Wiccan faith on her husband's memorial marker. On Thursday, after publicity about the omission, the White House scrambled to put things right. Stewart said she received phone calls from the Department of Defense. Officials told her name was inadvertently left off the list of guests they forwarded to the White House. Bush also called Stewart, and in a conversation she said lasted about 5 minutes, expressed regret over her exclusion. She said she told the president about the Wiccan faith, and the president replied, I don't know whether you believe me or not. Good opening line. But I hope you know this president would not dishonor a soldier, she said, is what Bush told her. White House press officer confirmed the call. Stewart is also a Wiccan. She fought an 18-month battle to get the Wiccan symbol engraved on a brass plaque for war heroes. Stewart, a Nevada National Guardsman, was believed to be the first Wiccan killed in combat. The Wiccan faith is based on nature and emphasizes respect for the earth. Some Wiccans call themselves witches or pagans. The Department of Veterans Affairs turned down Stewart's request because the Wiccan symbol was not among the 38 emblems, including ones for atheism and humanism, allowed for inscription on military markers at memorials. In April, after being sued by Americans for United for the Separation of Church and State, the VA agreed to add the Wiccan symbol to its approved list. So the government is in the business of approving religious symbols? Interesting. Interesting twist. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And in case you're wondering if there's more about Senator Larry Craig, there is, coming up surprisingly soon here on the show.
Well, sure, has been a quiet week in Lake Reverie my whole time. Eleanor Mangelt, who'd been working all summer as a lunchtime relief waitress at the Catbox Cafe, she had a tearful goodbye coffee with the other girls behind the counter during the 3 o'clock pee break. Eleanor's going back to Lutheran College for her senior year. She told Amy Hildebrandt, who's been waitressing at the Catbox Cafe for 27 years, that if Eleanor thought she was going to spend more than 2 summers at that job, she'd slit her wrists with a butter knife. Amy said she'd take that as a very left-handed compliment. It was a little sentimental at a St. Olaf's as well. This was the last week of alfresco bingo nights and the last of Miss Nora's iced tea socials following the conclusion of play. Father Newt picked out the winning numbers himself to commemorate the occasion, and he blushed redder than a reindeer's behind when the holder of the winning card turned out to be Miss Nora. Well, she tried to smooth things over by declaring that it was free iced tea for everybody. But by that point in the evening, the temperature had gotten down to the high 50s, so everybody just... the folks just bundled up and grumbled off. Maybe the biggest news in town this week, though, happened a couple hundred miles away. Stephen Olofsson, Ingemar's youngest son, was coming back from a little business conference he'd had to attend down in Milwaukee, don't you know. Ingemar had sent Stephen down there because the conference was one of those combination pep rallies and sales meetings, it was called every couple of months or so by the hardware chain that had bought out Ingemar's stake in the Maganales. Now, the chain people acted like they owned the place. That's what Ingemar liked to complain. Ignoring, I guess, just for the sake of his own pride, the fact that they did own the place. So when Ingemar's wife, Darla, faxed him the email notice of the big fall meeting in Milwaukee, the one where they're going to cover all the fine points of hardware's Christmas gifts, Ingemar snorted to Arne Jarlson, who just walked into the Bag of Nails to buy some AA batteries, that this was back to school time, one of the busiest seasons at the Bag of Nails, and he, Ingemar, wasn't going to leave one of his sons to mind the store while the merchandise just marched out of the store without so much as a rest stop at the cash register. Arnie pushed his $5 bill closer to Ingemar, hoping that that would speed up the transaction, but Inge had had a steam on him, and he told Arne that he was going to send Stephen, the gray sheep of the family, down to the conference. Stephen had been on duty at the Bag of Nails the day last fall when the sprinkler system went off, leaving Ingemar with several hundred dollars worth of non-sticky duct tape. And Ingi was happy to leave Stephen to the tender mercies of the True Neighbor Hardware people. Well, sure, as it turned out, Stephen had a lovely time down at the conference learning all sorts of marketing ideas, like a big cardboard Santa with a tool belt standing right at the entrance to the store. It was downright subliminal, is what the speaker said at the morning pancake sales boot camp. You didn't even need to make up a sign, he said, just the sight of a Santa with a tool belt sent the right message. Well, Stephen was determined to redeem himself in his father's eyes, not only with the tool belt Santa, but with a special promotion the True Neighbor people had signed him up for, the 12 Hammers of Christmas. Surveys indicated, you see, that most folks only had one kind of hammer in the house, and Stephen learned that that was the kind of opportunity that the True Neighbor Hardware people were going to spend $100 million on TV to take advantage of. So Stephen ordered a couple hundred of the 12 hammer collection, just figuring that once his friends and neighbors had seen the cute cartoon commercials featuring the reindeers just looking all around for the right hammer, that the collection would be as big a seller this year as the Bob Vila stud finder was last Christmas. So Stephen got off the plane in the Twin Cities airport with visions of sugar plums adorned with nail guns dancing in his head. And just before getting his car out of short-term parking, he ducked into the men's room. Now Stephen, being one of the younger set, he never went anywhere alone these days without his little iPod and his little earbuds, so he could always hear the polka music, the music that his dad would never allow in the sound system in the Bag of Nails. See, Ingemar thought polka music was old-fashioned and embarrassing and corny. He had an old tape of classic rock that was booming through the Bag of Nails. In fact, Lake Reverie's biweekly newspaper, The Whisperer, had just last year given the store one of the Best of Lake Reverie awards as the loudest store downtown. But like a lot of young folks these days, Stephen, we thought he could reconnect to his roots through listening to the Six Fat Dutchmen and Frankie Yankovic. So Stephen was sitting in his stall, minding his own business, listening to the Beer Pretzels polka. His right foot was tapping in time to the smiling Scandinavians, and all of a sudden, Stephen's aware of another foot. Another foot that's tapping right next to his, almost inside his stall, but not quite. Not quite in time to the music either, Stephen thought. Maybe the other fellow's iPod wasn't playing polka music either, because the tapping was slower, almost smooth jazz, slow. Well, sir, if anything could interrupt Stephen's concentration on the business at hand, it was that foot. So he gathered up his trousers, just before he stood straight up, something came under the stall divider, right toward him. Stephen remembered his dad's advice. Never pick anything up off a men's room floor or a bus station bench. But even from a standing position, Stephen could make out the business card. It had a fancy seal on it, the seal of the United States Senate. Stephen Olofsson put his iPod on pause and stood there thinking, was a United States senator interested in hardware? But after realizing there was nothing more he could figure out by just standing there, standing stock still and midwinter silent in the bathroom stall, Stephen decided to open the door and step outside. He took a deep breath and turned a little latch, and he saw an older, gray-haired, kind of bald-headed gentleman looking at him with a mischievous grin. At least the grin lasted for about a second, and it seemed to Stephen that the older gentleman was surprised or disappointed or something. All the gentleman said was, "I'm sorry." Usually the policeman sits in there. Well, sir, about 3 hours later, Stephen was back in Lake Reverie, telling Ingemar and Darla the whole story of the trip over some noodle salad. At the end of the story, Ingemar pushed his chair back from the table. He looked at Darla. Then he looked at Stephen. Then he said to his boy, "Son, you're crazy." Stephen was sure that his dad was going to accuse him of making up the whole airport incident, the way he'd made up the story about Cricket Hansen kissing him at the high school prom. But no, Ingemar just stared at his boy. A stare that had in it the memory of too many winters, not enough summer. He just stared at Stephen. Then finally, he told his son, "Nobody gives hammers for Christmas." That's the news from Lake Reverie for all the children and grown. Thank you so much.
Lord, in a rainbow a summer day that's fair, a prayer that's prayed, lament that's made, or goodbye said. Some shade of blue is there, blue, heaven's blue. They are all blues. The sea, the sky, and you and I, sea and sky and you and I, know all blues, all shades, all hues, all blues.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. Isn't it? It's soft.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Dateline Alberta. A combination of warm winters and Alberta's booming population is causing a recent jump in cougar attacks, says a spokesman for a Canadian government agency. The province's cougar population has jumped this year because recent warm winters have pushed up the population of deer, elk, and moose, the cougar's natural prey. And NASA scientists have developed a new climate model that indicates the most violent severe storms and tornadoes may become more common as Earth's climate warms. Reason enough for shutting down that whole NASA thing, don't you think? Previous climate model studies have shown that heavy rainstorms will be more common in a warmer climate, but few global models have attempted to simulate the strength of updrafts in these storms. The model developed at NASA was the first to successfully simulate the observed difference in strength between land and ocean storms and to estimate how the strength will change in a warming climate. From Science Daily. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, that's going to wick away the last bit of perspiration on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Radio up and down the east coast of North America, on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on the giant mighty 104 in Berlin, on both Sirius and XM satellite radio. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com, and is available as a free download at www.audible.com, and on the internet around the world at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, whenever you want it, live and archived. And it'd be just like having the air conditioning go off next weekend as well, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. By the way, if you see New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin in your vicinity, please FedEx him back. Not that we need him. Just like to know where he is. HarryShear.com is your one-stop destination for the playlist for this broadcast, as well as an email address that will get you directly to the proprietor of this broadcast. A tip of the Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. And thanks to Pam Halstead. I'm fixing to go outside and cool off. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans. Or as Anderson Cooper says, New Orleans. Yeah, right.